welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and I thank you so much for joining us on the program. And we come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are also rebroadcast on Sundays at 3 p.m. at a2zen.fm, as well as archiving the programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. And lots of opportunities for you to find out about our guests and what they're up to and what they have to offer. As I've said before, we do not invent. I did not reinvent the wheel. There's no reason for me to create all kinds of information and pages other than the homepage to let you know who's coming up that weekend. But we send you to their website, and we'll do the same thing with our guest today. A quick Angus update. He's getting bigger and faster and stronger and having a great time. And you can actually see some videos. I have yet to post the ones from May, June, and July, but you can see some of the growth that he's gone through since February. If you go to richarddugan.com/dogs, D-O-G-S, because you'll see both Angus as well as my dog. If you're interested in that kind of stuff, if you're not, I wouldn't suggest going there. But I would suggest checking out our guests, and we encourage you to do that. Today is the return of a guest that I've always enjoyed talking with ever since I met him. He is a professor of philosophy and critical thinking at Santa Barbara City College here in Santa Barbara, California. And he has a program that when the first go-around, 1.0, we'll call it, was on the air, he would have incredible guests on talking from perspectives that they got you, the perspectives got you to think. And I want to welcome back to our microphones Mark McIntyre. He is 40-plus years a professor of philosophy at Santa Barbara City College. And again, the people that you had on your program, Minds That Matter, which I think is a great title, they really did get you to think. And as you have stated many times on that program, as well as when you were on this program, believe it or not, 2 years ago, it's the same thing. I have been an unofficial student of, I suppose, philosophy, but more logical or critical thinking to solve problems, to the point that I try to consider all of the ramifications before I dive into something if I can help it, instead of just jumping in. Okay, we have a hole in the dike and we're just going to fill it with gum. Okay, now think that through to its logical conclusion, kids. Right. Or whatever the solution might be. I mean, I think about some of the natural disasters. I think about some of the conflicts around the world, especially the conflicts, and thinking we've got to address these differently, because every time we've addressed them the same way before, we're right back at the same doorstep again 10, 15, 20, 30 years later. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many presidents do you know as you were growing up to the present who have held a Camp David-like accords with the leaders of the Middle East to try to solve the Middle East problem?
The answer to that question is too many.
It's too many. Yeah.
First of all, I want to thank you for inviting me back on your show. I did not do a very good job in my own estimation.
That's your opinion.
I know, but I did not really drill down and give your listeners what they deserve, and they deserve an in-depth analysis as to what philosophy is and what philosophers do and how philosophy can influence practical affairs. The scenario you just set up in your setup introduction for the show is a perfect illustration. Why do we keep having the same conversations with people in the Middle East through Camp David Accords, and we never seem to get the problem solved? So perhaps today, by drilling down as to what philosophy is, what it does, and how it can be useful for every person on the planet, not just academics,
right?
I think that maybe we might be able to be of some help here.
I hope so. Well, let me give you my definition as I have found it. Philosophy is the study of general and fundamental problems such as those connected with reality, existence, knowledge, values, reason, mind, and language. Philosophy is distinguished from other ways of addressing such problems by its critical, generally systematic, now that's interesting, generally systematic approach, and its reliance on rational argument. I would.
That's
venture.
Not bad. That's not bad. Yeah, is
I
that
got
yours?
That from Wikipedia.
Oh, Wikipedia. Okay.
I didn't write that.
That's not bad. It needs a little tweaking, and, well, and we're going to drill down into
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Let's. Yeah. But let's jump into that one since we've brought it up about Camp David, the Camp David Accords, or whatever we want to call them over the last 30, 40, 50, however many years we've been doing this, and the participants have changed on both sides,
sure,
or all three sides, because we're there, the moderator, and yet we've never been able to resolve it. Which means that every time the new group of people get together to try to solve the problem, it sounds to me like they're rehashing the same old things. They're not coming up with anything new.
Right. And before we went on air, we had a little green room, you and I, and we were discussing that last century's philosophy has become, or does become, this century's ideology and political science. And that is one of the features about philosophy that I hope we can get to today. Namely that let me give you my own definition first of all, which I did not do the first time we had a show here. And I apologize to the listeners for that. But here it is. Here it is. Philosophy is the ongoing conversation that humans have with themselves, primarily, but with other interested persons, about just four basic questions. What is real? What is true? What is good? And what is beautiful? That's it. It's an ongoing conversation about those four basic questions. And the reason why I boil down your Wikipedia to that, which is really if you look at the Wikipedia.
Very general.
What I've done is I've boiled it down because there is no philosophical problem or question that you can mention that escapes one of those four questions that I just raised to you. They all devolve. They all have a common denominator. All philosophical questions. When we ask what is real, when we ask what is true, when we ask what is good, and when we ask what is beautiful, those are the most basic questions that any human being, person, would like to know, would like to know before they go 6 feet under. Okay, before we leave the planet, we really like to know what that is. And one of the most interesting quotes about what philosophy is came from Cicero, and he says, "Philosophy is the preparation for death."
I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, Cicero was a pretty clever guy. He was a pretty interesting character, and he captures in that quote the essence of the philosophical, and dare I use the word in this postmodern era, spirit of philosophy. Because philosophy is not a series of dogmas. It is not a series of canons, not the canon you fire off in the field, but canon as in canon law, canons as in coda, canons as in rules or dogmas. Now, philosophy is not that. There are some facts about philosophy that are mainly historical, and there are even some general topics, which is why your Wikipedia definition said generally speaking, or more or less systematic.
Yeah.
Okay. There are some general ideas, but all of these boil down to, and to get back to your observation, the reason why we have continuous strife in the world, human to human, nation to nation, village to village, town to town, ethnic group to ethnic group, religious group to religious group, the reason we have this is because we all differ in our proposed answers to those four questions.
See, that's where I'm coming from right now. As you went through reality and existence and good and beautiful, as often you hear the phrase, you know, art is in the eye of the beholder, you know, in terms of beauty, you know, and reality. You know, whose reality are we talking about?
That's exactly
here?
I mean, that's, the point.
And we go down that road, you know, to what's good to you.
Right.
Is necessarily good to
now,
me.
Now, you've landed on something very important. Okay. See how the precision of your inquiring mind, right, that matters. Your inquiring mind has led you to a very important insight, and that is that you cannot touch any of these four topics, reality, truth, goodness, or beauty. You can't touch any one without involving yourself in assumptions about the other three.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay? And that is what is so perplexing about philosophy, and that is what is so rejuvenative about philosophy, mm-hmm. and that is what is inspiring so much wonderment about philosophy, because philosophy begins in wonderment. We wonder why these things are the case.
Now, I want to go back to Cicero. Yeah. You said that Cicero made this statement,
yes,
that philosophy
is the preparation for death.
Why?
Because unlike trees, goats, monkeys,
rocks,
surf drops, whatever you want, whatever objects you want to name in the universe, galaxies, and we can go big, we can go small, mm-hmm. microbes, we can go anywhere in the universe, and we can denote or name anything we want. But there's only one thing we know of that actually struggles with consciousness, namely human beings. And in the mind of Cicero, and in the mind, by the way, of most of the famous Greek philosophers that we study in school, and ipso facto the Romans who imported Hellenistic culture mm-hmm. and made it their own and gave it their own twist, the essence of education has nothing to do with getting a job, has nothing to do with getting a good grade, has absolutely no practical value whatsoever. The purpose of an education is to become a person. A person. And what does it mean to become a person in Cicero's mind and the minds of the Hellenes and the minds of the early Roman thinkers in the West? Becoming a person is having an idea about those four basic things: reality, truth, goodness, and beauty. If you strive to formulate that every day you get up, when I get up every day, mm-hmm. every single day, those four questions are always on the table to be looked at anew. De novo, as though I had never considered them before.
Mm-hmm.
I jettison all the cultural expectations, like Marley's chains in A Christmas Carol clanking away. Mm-hmm. I jettison all of that. I leave that behind because I like to meditate at least an hour every day, sometimes while I'm swimming.
Mm-hmm.
And I go over, okay, Mark, what is today's attitude about what's real, what's true, what's good, and what's beautiful? Have those changed? And remarkably, or not, mm-hmm. they do change every day.
Deschardins, I believe it was, said, I think I'm wrong with this. I think, therefore, I am.
That was Rene Descartes. A Frenchman. You were in the right country.
Yeah. Wasn't it?
Rene Descartes.
Descartes.
And he started, Descartes is all the students of history of philosophy out there will jump at this one. Descartes is credited largely. It's generally agreed upon in philosophy that Descartes was the harbinger of what we call modern philosophy. Because what he did was very important. Before Descartes, we in the West philosophically thought of the problem of knowledge as between a knowing subject and a known object, like this coffee cup that's in front of me mm-hmm. here, or this microphone that's dangling out of the ceiling. We always thought that there was a subject, a knowing subject, and a known object. What Descartes did was Descartes said, well, you know, I can't really be quite absolutely certain about coffee cups and microphones, because he didn't have any microphone, but I can't really be so absolutely certain about the existence of material things. But what can I not doubt? He asked this question. What is it that I cannot doubt? And his answer was stunning to him. He said, I cannot doubt in the act of doubting that I'm doubting. Doubting is a thought. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am.
Okay.
It's a very simple equation. But with that one thought, with that one line of thinking, with that one line of reasoning, he pivoted all of what we call epistemology in philosophy. That's the formal study of the theories of knowledge. He moved it like, can you imagine moving the Queen Mary or a big battleship, turning it 180 degrees and going in the opposite direction? That's exactly what he did.
He turned it on a dime.
He turned it on a dime so that thereafter everyone was talking about knowledge is a subject-to-subject issue. It's not a subject-to-object issue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, not everybody agrees with this, but let me point out how important that is, how relevant this is today. What people commonly call relative ethics, social ethics, okay, a postmodernist ethics or
like,
postmodernist.
Are we talking like situational ethics?
Very good. That is a direct result of René Descartes' pivoting of epistemology 180 degrees, so that we now have come through, thank goodness, we have now come out of the fog of postmodernism. This whole idea that there's only a knowing subject, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. There's no reality, no truth, no goodness, no beauty, just the knowing subject. That reached its apex in the what's called the postmodernist thinkers of recent times, mm-hmm. the late 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century. Fortunately, that now has been discarded because of very simple facts. It is not the case. It is not the case that if I want to send a rocket ship to Mars, that I could build a rocket ship out of peanut butter and tuna fish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, I can hold the opinion. I can knock on the door of NASA. Oh, hello, NASA. I would like to go to Mars, and I have a new design for a rocket ship. Yes, Mark, what is your design for a rocket ship? I'm going to build one out of peanut butter and tuna fish. Well, I hope that works out for you, Mark. Please let us know, and we'll get back to you on that. Okay? Okay. So the postmodernists are wrong.
Right.
There is a reality.
Yeah.
There is a truth. We do get rocket ships built, manufactured, launched and out there to Mars, and we get them there on time. So it is not the case that there is no objective reality. The question is, how do we know that reality, and how can we know it with certainty?
I want to go back to his statement, I think, therefore I am.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
What? I think, therefore I am. What?
A thinking thing. He did answer the question.
Okay.
If you read the Meditations 1, 2, and 3, he does answer it. He does answer the question. He said, I'm not quite sure of myself as an extended bodily thing. I have this thing I think is a body. And I'm not quite sure about that because, you know, there are mirages. I could be illusion. I could be on bad drugs. You know, I could be, you know, smoking cocaine. I don't know. I may be delusional.
So
I may
even
be insane.
He theorized that he was not his body.
Oh, he was the first to make it a household idea. Go ahead.
Now, just Cicero.
Yeah.
Give me a year point of reference.
Oh, gosh. Cicero is going to be probably 200 BC.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've been reading and studying about philosophy going back even further.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
So
you want to go back there?
I guess first of all have concluded that nothing comes out of a vacuum.
Right.
And mm-hmm. that when any religious movement comes along mm-hmm. and claims to be the end all and be all and we are it, and we're separate from all the others,
right.
I go, that's impossible.
Well, see, now you've touched upon another thing, Richard. Another very important thing you've touched upon is that that what you just described is unlike anything that philosophy has to do with. Philosophy is not precisely that. Precisely, there is no one way in philosophy.
Okay.
Religions do have the one way, otherwise they wouldn't have a religion, right?
That's true. Okay.
So, and some religions are more tolerant and more flexible and more welcoming of diverse ideas. But basically, any religion that gets established, we're talking established, is in the business of one thing, perpetuating itself in existence.
And in politics, it's this. I would have to say that
there
the same thing applies to that as does
exactly.
religion.
Exactly.
So even though we can go back hundreds,
thousands
and thousands of years, even before Cicero,
mm-hmm.
to other philosophical schools of thought,
mm-hmm.
they are, we don't want to say they're independent of one another,
mm-hmm.
but that they had their place. And let's just say, what were the philosophies that Cicero learned from?
Good question.
That brought him to, I mean, because each thing is a stepping stone.
Yeah, they're called the Pre-Socratics.
Before
Socrates.
We're talking about Socrates. Okay.
Before Socrates. And these mainly were, now we're going back 500, 600, 700, 800 years before the birth of Christ.
Okay.
And these people, called pre-Socratics, Thales and Anaximander and Anaximenes, these names probably don't mean anything to your listeners, but these were the people who are making the first crude stabs at what is real.
Okay.
And how can I know that it's real? For instance, Thales thought that the whole universe was basically composed of water. So basically, and then there was others who said, no, it's not water, it's air. No, it's fire. So you had them all. And then there was another guy called Anaximenes who said, you know, it's not any of those material things. It is some non-material thing. It is some non-tangible thing. Thus, the beginning of what we have in the West, which is the matter-spirit dichotomy. Mm-hmm. The famous matter-spirit dichotomy, which continues to be the most burning philosophical question. If you go to any class in philosophy or read any philosophical book, I just became aware of Thomas Nagel's new book today. He's an atheist, by the way, but he has now come out with a new book that says, hey, physicists and biologists, I got news for you. Ideas, concepts, perceptions, intuitions, emotions, feelings, they're not material, yet they exist. They're real.
Yeah.
They're real, folks. And so all the atheists and the materialists, they're pulling out their hair saying, my goodness, how can you be an atheist and believe something like that? Because Mr. Nagel is a philosopher. Okay? Yeah. He's not a religious person.
Yeah.
His primary interest is in philosophy, not religion.
I've had the opportunity of interviewing an atheist, and I actually am looking forward to the opportunity of doing it again in the future because I find I find the atheist perspective fascinating because it is not devoid, in conversing with this one gentleman, it is not devoid of spirituality.
Right.
It is devoid of religiosity.
Right.
It is devoid of all of the trappings, the doctrine, the dogma, and so on and so forth. And even this gentleman whose name I should remember and I don't, basically he spoke of very spiritual constructs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, you made a very important distinction. By the way, making distinctions is one of the most useful things that philosophy can teach our students. I have developed 20 distinctions, which lead off my textbook, Reason, Argue, and Refute. Mm-hmm. It's the textbook I use for critical thinking classes. But I start off with 20 distinctions. And one of the distinctions you just pointed out to is very valid. And that is the distinction between being a religious person and being a spiritual person.
Yeah.
Very, very different things. But most people use these words interchangeably. If we can only stop using words interchangeably, we use synonyms or what we think is a synonym. Mm-hmm. Synonym. We use them for instance, knowledge and belief. That's my biggest one.
Oh, yeah.
How many, and I always ask my class, I say, how many people drove their car here to campus? And about half the people raise their hand. I say, okay, do you any of you people who drove, do you know where your car is? Oh, yes, I know where my car is. It's over there in the parking lot. And then I say, well, how many people think that they're wrong? Very few people raise their hand. And then I ask this, here's the clinching question. Do you know where your car is, or do you merely believe you know where your car is? And you see this dawn. You see their faces change, right? One year, when I did this in class, a student went out of class, and his car had been towed.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. His car had been towed, and there was a dry spot. It had raining that day, and there was a dry spot under where his car used to be. And he said, son of a gun, that McIntyre, I'm going to kill him. He came back into class. He
said,
how did you know?
It's kind of like the situation that we get into in relationships where you have two individuals, male, female, in there.
Yeah.
She says, did you do thus and such?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, before she asks the question, he knows, I certainly did do that.
Right.
Absolutely, I did it.
Right.
But she begins to question and then question again and again. Are you sure?
Mm-hmm.
I've had this happen to me, and I start to doubt, and so I have to go check. I have to go into the proverbial parking lot.
Exactly.
And
I believe my car is outside the studio right now. I don't know.
And then I realize, by checking, I did.
Yeah, I can go
and
look.
And I should have stayed confident in the knowledge that I knew that I had done it.
It is for this reason that in courts of law, you will be cross-examined. If you are a witness, and any competent attorney who's trained in philosophy, trained in logic, by the way, these individuals will pick this up. If you say, well, you know, I believe the suspect was 7 feet tall and wore a polka dot dress. Ah, that's very interesting, Mr. McIntyre. You believe that the suspect, do you believe that, Mr. McIntyre, or do you really know that he was wearing a polka dot dress? Okay.
Yeah.
And this gets back to the four questions.
Yeah.
Reality, truth, goodness, and beauty. There is something called truth.
Yeah.
It exists.
In
it's
our
real.
Age, technologically, that becomes even greater a question in my mind when hearing and knowing, well, I don't know this. All I know is what I've heard
right.
about the way in which the information that we get comes in,
mm-hmm.
how it's – the
processed,
word is vetted.
Yeah.
And processed. Actually, vetted isn't the right word. Processed is
processed.
A better word, because
yeah.
a vetting is more mm-hmm. systematic. It's more mm-hmm. logical, whereas just processing, they just – this is what we want you to hear. This is what we want you to know.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we talked about at the beginning of this program about conflicts around the world. And we heard reports, for example, out of Syria
mm-hmm.
that the government – used
right.
chemical weapons against its own
Very
people.
Very good example. Very
and
good example.
And I'm sitting here going, okay, you do have the knowledge that chemical weapons were used
mm-hmm.
on Syrians.
Right, by the government officials.
But you don't know that it was by the government officials.
Right.
You don't know that for a fact. You are assuming
right. Right.
because
and,
they may or may not have them.
And
now
the,
stories are coming out that, oh, it was actually the rebels. And it's like, we don't know.
Well,
we don't have.
Well,
I mean, they haven't come out with ironclad evidence. And the way that things are manipulated, the way information is manipulated, which is, I think, a better distinction than processed.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of what the story is, it's like when a certain event is happening. Well, we've even experienced this where they will show us a video
mm-hmm.
of something that took place.
Right.
But as you began to question the witnesses,
mm-hmm.
as well as the participants,
mm-hmm.
you start to get a whole different story
sure.
from what the picture,
mm-hmm.
they say a picture is worth 1,000 words,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily the right ones.
Mm-hmm. That's why for police always separate witnesses to an accident. They
yeah.
separate them and then they interview them separately. Then they go back to the headquarters and they say, well, you know, let's compare stories. You get 7 different versions of the accident.
Exactly.
7 different. Okay. To tie up this question
yeah.
that you – very good example, by the way, because serious listeners to information – pick up exactly what you have just picked up. Let's take this chemical weapons issue in Syria, the recent issue. Even the UN report that was finally delivered
mm-hmm.
does not even claim to prove that the Assad regime used the chemical weapons.
Right.
They offer empirical proof that chemical weapons were used,
right.
but they did not offer any because there isn't any in their mind,
right.
they found no credible evidence that either one side or the other side actually used them. So we don't know.
We don't.
And so there you are, okay? So we're going to drop bombs on civilians
yeah.
based upon the fact that we don't know which group did what is being claimed to
yeah.
do?
It's the flawed logic of...
Yeah.
Okay, I grew up in a family of 6 kids.
Yeah.
And if none of us were willing to fess up mm-hmm. to the accusation that a particular thing happened,
mm-hmm.
I broke that, somebody broke this glass. Now, who was it?
Right.
So instead, and this is the logic they're using for Syria.
Right.
Instead of punishing the person who broke the glass,
yeah.
they punish them all.
Right, right.
That
right.
makes no sense.
Using another example from the headlines as to how philosophy can be very helpful in
yeah.
untangling this mess, you've seen in the recent days that the CEO of Starbucks
mm-hmm.
Has said that people who have a carry concealed or an open carry permit for a gun are not welcome in the Starbucks stores. And you've,
mm-hmm.
you've seen that.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And their reasoning is that guns kill.
Yeah.
I was watching Sky News, and they had a series of reporters on, and one of them in particular, she ended her interview, she said, well, people are just really sick and tired of all these news stories about people being killed by guns. Guns killing people, people being killed by guns.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to only just think for a gun. No gun has ever killed anyone. People using guns have.
Mm-hmm.
But guns, you can put a gun on this table between us right now and leave it there for all of eternity.
Right.
It will never kill anyone.
Exactly.
Ever.
Exactly.
Ever. But uncritical thinkers, they listen to these half-wit reporters on television who are paid to spin a certain ideology, in this case, anti-gun,
yeah.
okay, or anti-Assad in the other case that you mentioned, because they're not critically thinking.
Yeah.
You said it was a problem of logic. It's not even a problem of logic, Richard. It's a problem of epistemology. How do you know something with certainty?
Yeah.
Where's
okay.
the evidence?
Okay.
That's all you got to do is, where's the evidence for this stuff?
Well, and I'd even take it one step. As a matter of fact, I can't even take it one step further. I'm going to take it on a different tangent for only a second.
Sure, yeah.
It isn't guns that kill people. It's bullets. Go after the bullet manufacturers. That's what
well,
you got to do.
They're also
and they're doing that.
That
now. They're taxing the bullets.
Right.
I know that.
But in reality, a bullet can be in a loaded gun, and for all of eternity, it takes a human being to take the gun and kill somebody.
Yeah. Or I'll take a box of bullets and I'll just throw them at you.
Right.
We'll see what happens.
Right. But it is this type of critical non-thinking or non-critical thinking.
Non-critical thinking.
Non-critical thinking that pervades our environment.
Before we take our break, there's one other example I want to throw out, and that is there's a current movie that's being promoted. It's going to be out here. Maybe it's this weekend. Maybe it's next. And the line in the promo for this movie is, it is the best reviewed movie. And I'm going, no. Wait a minute. Every movie I've been to where I listened to the reviewer say this is a great movie, it, from my perspective, it was terrible.
Mm.
And every movie I've ever been to where I ignored the critics or the reviewers, this is a terrible movie, I loved. I'm not sure what that says about me, but what to me was fascinating was that whole line. This is the best reviewed movie. What does that mean? Does that mean that you had more people reviewing this movie than any other movie in history? And then that takes me to the other, real quick, the other issue about movies, when they give us the statistics at the end of a weekend. The highest grossing. What does that mean? Nothing. It just means that, I mean, because ticket prices are different all over the country.
Sure.
How many people went to that movie? That's what I want to know.
Right.
How many tickets were sold? Not how much was earned. How many tickets were sold? That will tell me something. Doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to do anything about it. It just tells me that 5 million people instead of 10 million went to that movie versus this
sadly,
movie.
Sadly, Richard, we are not taught how to think in our society. We are only taught what to think. And that's why critical thinking, which is what I teach in class, which is why it's getting a comeback. It's making a comeback.
Now, I'm wondering, do you know, before we take our break, do you know if this concept is in any way, shape, or form being brought into the grade school or high school level? Because that's where it needs
to start. There's good news and there's bad news. Okay, there's good news.
What's the good news?
The good news is that I've been teaching for 43 years. By the way, I want to shout out to Michael Griffin, who's probably listening to the show. I had Michael in class 43 years ago, and we still communicate.
That's extraordinary. That
and,
is wonderful.
Yeah, and I'm very proud of that. But I just wanted to say hi, Mike, and I'm always very grateful for your observations. But to get back to your very, very good question, the good news is that it is getting better. Okay? Now, it's getting better because, believe it or not, critical thinking and writing, the course, the class, and the content that I teach is embedded in state California statute. Did you know this?
Really?
Yes. It's embedded. Now, it's not always taught the way I teach it. It's not always taught the way the statute prescribes. But at least it's there. At least you cannot get certain degrees anymore without taking a critical thinking and writing class. You can't. It's impossible. It's a state requirement for nursing, for psychology. There are a whole host of majors. You cannot do it. Okay. The bad news is it's not taught very well, usually, okay? For critical thinking, for some professors, it only amounts to, well, you read that poem. How do you feel about that poem? Do you like that poem? Oh, you don't. Isn't that too bad? Let's move on to the next poem. Okay, what we teach, what the statute, what the state law says, we have to teach logic. We have to teach argumentation. We have to teach syllogistic reasoning. We have to teach a student the distinction between a valid argument and a sound argument.
Yeah.
And maybe after the break, we can give you a sample of one of those.
We will do that. Right. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. We're talking with philosophy professor Mark McIntyre. He teaches at the City College here at Santa Barbara City College in Santa Barbara, California. And we're going to continue on. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And I'm going to throw another monkey wrench into the whole thing by bringing up the whole issue of mythology, because we were talking about the Greeks before. We'll be back in just a moment.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, along with Mark McIntyre. He is a professor of philosophy at Santa Barbara City College, and it's critical thinking as well. It's more than just philosophy from what I'm gathering, and I just find that fascinating. Now, I did throw the monkey wrench in about mythology, which we will get to, and in our program first of this month when we celebrated the end of our... What was it? The end of our sixth year on the air and beginning of seven. And by the way, that was something else that was real interesting, was the fact that when I was growing up, I realized that when my birthday rolled around, I didn't have a birthday celebration the day I was born. So when I turned 1 year, when I lived the first 365 days, that was my first birthday, and I was now beginning my second year.
Okay.
I mean, this was just the way I thought about it.
Yeah.
So I am—
You didn't count the womb.
No,
okay.
I did not, because that then throws it all off. Because you're not— if you were in there 12 months, the math would be so much easier. Okay,
I know some people that were in there 12 months.
Well, but yes, anyway, some people should still be
right
in the world.
Exactly. Okay. Right.
But so we ended our sixth year and we began our seventh year. Seven is an important number to me, and
right,
it's all that good stuff. But anyway,
right, congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. Want to let our listeners know, too, that there is going to be more to this interview than meets the ear, because when this radio program is over, there's more at the website, richarddugan.com radio show page in the archives. And if you're listening to the A to Zen broadcast, there's more. There is more to this interview, because we go beyond the limitations of the time constraints that are placed on us, rightly so, so that other folks can have their points of view as well.
Yeah. Sure.
Now, we talked a little bit about— I talk a little bit about the points on a circle.
Yes.
And the point of this program is to bring to light as many of the points on a circle. We go back to the example of a traffic accident. I remember years ago, I was taking photography class back in the 80s, early 80s, and black and white. And I took a bunch of pictures, which I still have, of a car accident, the aftermath.
Uh-huh.
And from all different angles. I was— I wasn't working for the police or anything. I was just taking pictures.
Yeah.
And one of the main thoughts that came to my mind was, you know, I bet you that if I was to talk to any one of the people that are in the photographs that are looking at the aftermath, they would all give— and if they saw the incident, they would all give different stories, as we talked about before.
Quite to be expected, yeah.
But one of the aspects of this whole aspect of critical thinking, I don't recall taking any class in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to make the— I hate to use this word. I'm going to try to find another word. I'm going to come to the conclusion.
Infer?
I'm going to infer that somehow, somewhere along the way, it became part of my DNA that I inherited.
I think it was always part of your DNA. I don't think that you learn this. I think you pop out of the womb either a curious individual or a non-curious individual. I really believe that. In my experience, having dealt with thousands of students over the last 43 years, some students you cannot possibly stimulate them to be curious or critical. The other students, you cannot repress them. You cannot stop them, in my experience.
I found it fascinating, and we kind of discussed this a little bit in our first interview, where when I was working for the religious radio station, I was asking a lot of hard questions, and many of these questions went unanswered until one gentleman said to me, "Why don't you just read the writings of the founding fathers of the faith?"
Right.
Which most of them at that time I had never heard of before.
Sure.
Which then raised two more questions, and that is,
who are they?
Who put them? Yeah, right. Who gave them the nameplates and the badges and the position and the title of founding fathers? And if I'm asking these questions today in 1980, whatever, 1990, whatever it was, then doesn't that— and again, this was with all due humility— then doesn't this put me in the same category and class as them?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if I've never heard of them before, and now I'm asking these questions, sure, wanting answer to these questions, mm-hmm, why would I read their writings?
Mm-hmm. Well, what you've hit upon there is the fact that some religions have a hierarchical structure for faith and knowledge.
Yeah.
That is to say, God whispers in the ear of the Pope. The Pope whispers in the ear of the cardinals. The cardinals, the priest, the laity. So if you stand by for a bulletin from God, you have to wait till it comes down the chain of command. Now. That's the old Catholic model.
Right,
of it.
Right.
The Protestants figured out a very different way of doing it. It's up to you as an isolated human individual to interpret the scriptures. And I'm not a Protestant, by the way.
Right.
In fact, I don't subscribe to any organized religion whatsoever. And I can tell you my views on that if you think that's interesting. I don't think it's that interesting. But the baseline here is that Protestants figured out that it's the, back to Descartes, it's the knowing subject.
Yeah.
That you find God within. You don't find God in galaxies and supernovas. You don't find God in microbes and subatomic particles. You find God within the human consciousness.
Yeah.
Søren Kierkegaard, for instance, the famous existentialist writers, the theological, the theist existentialist like Kierkegaard, and to some extent Teilhard de Chardin. It's a process of within. It's a process of within. It's a journey within. So it's much more philosophical. Modern Protestant thought is much more philosophical than its predecessor.
Right.
Because it did exactly what you did. Who are these people to tell me that this is the dogma? I have to believe it. Well, I'm an intelligent individual. I can think for myself. And that's the very point. You can.
I found it interesting, too, in terms of also studying Deschardins' writings as well, in a group that I was a part of for a number of years back in Phoenix. And there was, in the study group, they handed out this poem. It was great, a great poem.
Mm-hmm.
That I've paraphrased a number of times, and I need to get it out of the notebook and bring it in and read it and give credit to the author. Mm-hmm. But it's basically the gods, and they are talking about how man is becoming so wise and so forth, and he's going to start searching everywhere for how to become like us.
Yeah.
And so they start debating over where they're going to hide this knowledge. We'll hide on the mountaintops. No, he'll find a way to climb the mountains and get to it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll put it down in the deepest parts of the oceans.
Right.
No, he'll find a way. And and they go on and on and on and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. Three or four or five or six different examples until finally one of them realizes the best place to hide this knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
We'll hide it in the heart of man. He
exactly.
will
yeah.
never mm-hmm. look there.
Right.
And even in the writings, as I call them, the ancient wisdom teachings,
mm-hmm.
they all speak to the heart.
Mm-hmm.
That is,
mm-hmm.
and even science today, mm-hmm. in the interviews I've had, say with Greg Braden and, mm-hmm. and the folks from HeartMath,
yep.
The science is proving that the heart is the seat not only of the blood flow, but, and they say that life is in the blood, but that the heart is the seat of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of emotion a little differently. Certainly crying and laughing and so forth is part of our emotional state. But emotion,
mm-hmm.
energetic movement,
mm-hmm.
and then that takes us more into soul and spirit,
yes.
and those types of things.
Interesting you should bring that up, because even Aristotle did not believe that the mind existed in the brain. Did you know that?
Really?
Yeah. No, they thought it was in the heart.
And even that's even debated today as far as it being in the mind.
Yeah.
But
and he was the guy that actually started biology. I mean, he invented so many sciences, botany, biology, paleontology, geology. He invented all these sciences.
Interesting.
But, you know, you mentioned before the break that we were going to discuss mythology. And I want to bridge this for you. One of the problems I see with organized religions has been historically is that they keep insisting, many of them, not all of them, by mm-hmm. the way, but many of them, many of the ones who have this top-down hierarchy, who have a sort of an objectivist view of things, not the subjective people like the existentialists, but the religions that are having the most difficulty these days
mm-hmm.
in keeping their faithful and in convincing the unfaithful is that they keep insisting on defining God anthropomorphically, that is to say, like humans.
Mm-hmm.
And in my view, it's almost insulting to the very concept of God It's sort of inelegant and indecorous to confine God to like an older, grayer, wiser kind of version of Mark McIntyre or Richard Dugan or Barack Obama,
right.
Heaven forbid. But I mean, but why, you know, the reason why we do this, Richard, is because of mythology.
Right.
And here's the connection. Here's how to connect the dots. Today, if you turn on the weather report, and it's going to be raining in Northern California, or in Edinburgh, Scotland. Hello, Matthew Bixby. little shout there. Let's say you see this rain is going to rain in Edinburgh this afternoon. Okay. Now, no one in his right mind today believes for a nanosecond that the rain in Edinburgh is caused by Zeus urinating through a sieve.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But there was a time in human history that people actually believed, they didn't know, but they believed that Zeus urinating through a sieve was the cause of rain. Okay? So this is what I mean by anthropomorphic, human-like form, anthropos, and then morphic. Okay? We, for some strange reason, cling to this notion that God has to be a perfected version of our imperfected nature.
Yeah.
And to me, that's inelegant and indecorous, and it's an insult to the very concept of God.
Well,
insulting.
And I have to say that I struggled for years. I probably could say that in addition to my 15 years in broadcasting at the religious station, it was also sort of like a anti-seminary of sorts. It was the greatest education I was ever paid for.
Right.
But one of the things that came out of that, it took me 5 years to be able to let go of the concepts of the devil and hell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the reason why it took so long was twofold. Number one was because every time I was ready to let go, this nagging thing in the back of my mind would go, yeah, but what if they're right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What if the Christians are right?
Yeah.
And then I began to logically think, and I also began interviewing rabbis who are adept, so well studied in the ancient languages of both Hebrew and Aramaic and so forth. And I began to, in addition to get the actual definitions as are used in the Bible of the devil and Satan and hell, and realizing that those weren't real live entities out there somewhere. They were the lowest base nature of man. Mm-hmm. It was our character that was being represented by those words in those
passages.
Yeah,
but there was a point where they actually believed that these were objects.
That's right.
Real entities.
Exactly.
Entities. So that brings you back to this
anthropomorphizing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if you look at the history of human evolution and consciousness, just in terms of consciousness, I mean, the Richard Dawkins of the world, who is a leading atheist, who wrote the famous book, The God Problem. He's a biologist, okay? Mm-hmm. His book is one grand ad verecundiam fallacy, because he's very skilled as a biologist, but he knows nothing about theology, and he knows nothing about philosophy. Nothing. Zero. Mm-hmm. Zip. Nada. Niente. Okay? But he's very popular. He was even knighted by the queen. Why?
Right.
Because he says, everything is physical. Everything is physical, and everything evolved just the way Darwin had predicted. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we know that that's not the case. We just know that that's not the case. There are things, as Nagel says in his new book, there are things that we know exist, like emotions, intuitions, feelings, suspicions, perceptions, concepts, ideas, patterns, relationships.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things actually exist. But if you listen to the Dawkins people, who somehow think that what they have discovered in biology disproves religion or disproves the existence of a particular kind of God, these people are insane.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very popular.
Yeah.
Okay? Very popular.
Yeah.
Because there's a need for people to get rid of the parent God. Daddy's mad at me. And if daddy finds out that I slept with my neighbor's wife, then daddy's going to be sending me to a hot place forever called hell. And I don't want that. I want to go to a place where I'm floating on a cloud eating grapes supplied by daddy. Daddy will give me plenty of grapes, and I'll be floating on a cloud forever and ever. So it is this very childlike idea of God that's the problem.
Yeah.
It's not God itself. It's
right.
not God.
No, no, no.
And you notice I didn't say the word himself. I said it's not the concept of God itself.
Right.
But it's the manifestations. It's the mythological.
Yeah.
The mythological adaptations of God that we have cluttered our cultures with.
Well, one of the aspects that struck me as I was going through this education, as I talked about, was the conclusion that I came to the then conclusion that I kind of still hold to today, that none of this made any sense, because what was being described to me about the dynamics of the relationship between God and man was nothing short of extortion.
Right.
That
right, right, right.
If
right.
you believe, you will be eating grapes provided by daddy.
Yeah, right.
And if you don't believe, you will
you're
be
shoveling coal.
You're shoveling coal.
Right.
So
right.
it wasn't, and you get to choose.
Yeah.
You have free will.
That's free will.
To choose.
Right.
But you don't really, because you're being extorted. You are out of, by fear, which as I read and continued to read throughout the Bible, was not the nature of God, especially
right.
in the New Testament.
Right.
It made no sense that God would use fear slash extortion to get me to comply to a set of rules to live by.
Right.
Whereas it would just be a whole lot easier if I made the decision to do quote unquote, the right things, the moral things. And I loved the definition. I heard this in when I was married the first time, we went through an engaged encounter. We had to do this in order to get married in the church.
Sure, right.
And they said, "Do you? We're going to give you a new definition of the word moral. Life-giving. And if it's not life-giving, then it's not moral." But see, then we still
seems,
get into
seems
that,
rather vague and ambiguous.
But we still get into the same. That's right. We still get into that same.
Really
thing.
Vague and ambiguous.
In terms of being compassionate to one another, in terms of kind.
Yeah,
and,
the relational aspects of religion.
Exactly.
Yeah, relational
exactly.
aspects. Sure.
And so that's what was focused on. I thought, wouldn't it be just easier if I just lived my life in a life-giving manner?
Well, that's what
towards
people
myself
are doing.
And
that's
others.
Exactly. You're describing exactly what modern religious thinkers are doing. That's exactly what they're doing.
But I've
doing.
Noticed
they're
that it has changed. Even
they're,
since
they're getting
then.
Rid of this daddy God. You know, religion heretofore has been a daddy issue and a mommy issue.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's been very psychological, almost psychiatric in a way, okay? Driving yourself crazy with this preoccupation. But today, modern religious thinkers are getting away from that, getting back to the relational aspects of spirituality.
Right.
And those religions that support that are being attracted.
Right. Well, one of the interesting factors that I found was, as of late, I've been hearing this, in relationship to the things that are of God and the things that are of the devil. And I'm hearing now today, I heard this not too long ago, and I kind of already was aware of this. You cannot categorize anything that exists in the universe today as bad, i.e., then there's good, if it was all created by God. I mean, think about it.
Okay.
Even the
okay.
story
yeah, 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 yeah.
of,
I know,
and I don't want to go too far here.
No, I know where you're going, and this is one of the major objections called the problem of evil.
Right.
And the question is framed this way. Every philosophy student that we reprocess, like cheese, or bologna.
Take your pick.
More like bologna.
That's a good sandwich, by the way.
Anyway, cheese and bologna. Okay, it's called the problem of evil. And here's how the problem is set up.
Okay.
People ask the question, well, how can there be a good, omnipotent, all-knowing, and all-loving God? And children are born without arms and legs, and people get swallowed up by typhoons, and there's evil in the world. Oh, no, this can't be. This is a contradiction. Okay. The problem here is that the way they're defining the God.
Yes.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Okay. certainly, if there was a kind of Christian God or Judaic God, the prime mover, all knowing. Let's suppose for a moment there was this type of a God, this person God, this one big daddy in the sky,
right.
Who's got like an Excel spreadsheet and a little a green eye shade, and he's got a laptop computer. Every time you masturbate or every time you sniff cocaine, that's bad. That's bad. Yeah. So okay, let's suppose for a moment, just for a second, that's true. Okay. That doesn't mean that the existence of evil in the world is that God's fault. I mean, logically speaking, no. It may be that there's a plan beyond human knowledge. Alvin Plantinga, by the way, mm-hmm. a contemporary professor of philosophy at Notre Dame, Plantinga, his solution to the problem of evil is very simple. There's a plan. And we don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
But in order for us to have free will, God could not have created a universe without the possibility of evil, without the possibility of choosing evil, which we call sin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a very reasonable philosophical response to the problem. There are many responses to the problem.
Sure, sure.
So anytime you hear people say, oh, there can't be the God of the Christians or the Jews because there's evil in the world, that's just nonsense.
Yeah.
That's like saying you can't have morality without believing in God.
Right.
Of course
yeah.
you can.
Yes, you can.
Of course you can.
Yeah. I find it interesting, too. I heard a comedian talking about this kind of thing, and he says, the only conclusion that I can come to is that God is schizophrenic because he made one heck of a twist between the Old and the New Testament. I mean, he became really loving and good and kind, and thank you very much. I think that the one thing that I concluded, and this was all based upon what I was aware of at the time,
yeah.
was that none of that made any sense to me as far as the whole argument I brought up earlier.
Right.
Because if God created everything
right.
and he created me,
right.
I had to have had value for him to have created me in the first place. And right. then this is all going based upon the old paradigm, the old doctrine and dogma. And ergo,
and this is a show about new paradigms.
It is indeed. Okay. And we're actually going to jump into that in just a moment. I thought, no, we're not. Because, see, I kept hearing that we were nothing but lowly worms.
Right.
This is the message.
Lowly worms?
Oh, it was even worse. I mean, just nothing. We were nothing.
I see what you mean. Metaphorically, yes.
Metaphorically.
Yeah.
And I thought, that doesn't make any sense. Mm. Why would this God, as it's been described, go through this long, drawn-out process— for us 2,100 years ago,
mm-hmm.
if we had no value in the first place.
Well, it
was so
okay.
inconsistent okay, to me. It, the but, logic wasn't
no,
there.
No, the logic is there if you accept certain assumptions of original sin, Garden of Eden, and the redemptive, the fall from grace. If you accept the assumptions that you're given in the Christian God paradigm,
yeah.
okay, it does make sense. You can make sense out of it, and it there's no illogic. There's no contradiction.
Yeah, but
It's just like, okay, if let's suppose you build a sandbox in the park next to your house and nobody sees it that you built it, but you build it at night.
Right.
So you built the sandbox because you notice the children don't have any sandbox, but you built the sandbox. So you build it at night. Nobody saw you build it. The next day, the kids show up with their parents and there's a sandbox. So the kids play in the sandbox. Now, during the first day of play, one kid takes a shovel and beats the other kid over the head. Did you cause that by creating the sandbox? No.
Yeah.
So by analogy, it's stupid to think. It's ridiculous. It's illogical to think that simply because there is a God of a certain type
right.
that created a certain kind of universe that permits evil, that therefore that God is responsible for evil.
Well, it even goes back to the example of one of us siblings breaking the glass. None of us fess up and all of us get punished.
Exactly.
It's the same argument.
Exactly. So the problem is how we define God.
Yeah. I think
that's the problem.
Yeah.
If you let go of this angry, the Hebrews were very smart. If you read the Old Testament, there are four different traditions in the Old Testament, and they're characterized by the words that they use for God. There's the Elohim mm-hmm. Tradition. There's the Adonai mm-hmm. tradition. There's the Messiah tradition, and then there's one tradition that always has fascinated me. When Father McLean taught me this when I was studying philosophy. And that is, there was a period in Jewish history, and I'm not quite certain, I'm not going to give you the dates because I can't remember them, but there was a period, if you study ancient Jewish versions of the Old Testament, where the rabbis erased the word for God. They erased it. They took it out. They used whiteout, or they used whatever they used,
right.
whatever their equivalent for whiteout was. They took their sacred text, their Torah, and they reprocessed them, wiping out the word of God. Now, you ask why? Why did they do that? Because they came to the conclusion, philosophically, that it was an insult to God to put a, when we name something in Jewish tradition, if I know your name, I have power over you. What's your name? Okay. Mm-hmm. Jewish tradition is very, very keen on names. Okay. And this is because it is a name is a container. It's a box that I'm going to put you in. Oh, you're a Democrat. Oh, you're a Republican. Oh, you're a Christian. Oh, you know, you're an Irishman. Okay.
Right.
That's a box I can put. Now I have power over you. I can manipulate you in my mind and you can, I can do whatever I want with you. So the Jews during this period, they simply erased all the words of God, okay? Because they thought it was sacrilegious to contain the uncontainable, to limit the limitless.
And I would,
and I agree with that.
I would agree with the
logic
behind
that. I think that's really cool. That's really, it's really cool.
As a matter of fact, I remember hearing where you were not allowed to utter whatever the name of God was, you were not allowed to utter it.
Right. Yahweh or whatever it was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It just shows you what your point was earlier. Is that there is a connection between mythology, because mythology was our first attempt to humanize, to anthropomorphize natural events like rain and storms and fires. We have Poseidon, where is he? Neptune and Poseidon. What do they rule? Well, they rule the oceans, right? So if there's a shipwreck, well, it's Neptune. Yeah. You know, capsized my boat.
Well, on the first Saturday of September, we sat and spoke with Will Lynn about one of the Greek gods, who could be the Greek god for this program, Prometheus.
Oh, Prometheus.
The god of paradigms. Yes, and he brought the first paradigm. Supposedly, he brings two.
The Prometheus.
The first one is fire.
Yep.
And then the second one is a higher consciousness.
Exactly.
And I feel as though... I shared with him as well that, you know, I'm not a student of the Greek Greek mythology or the gods. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with some of the names. I read a book called The Prometheus Project. It was a science fiction book, and I just found it so fascinating as we talked more, because I began to look at a particular television series in our modern time, obviously. A friend of mine.
Breaking Bad?
I'm sorry?
Breaking
no,
Bad?
No, not that one. Although it's a very
I love
it's
that
an
show.
Interesting
I
twist.
I love that show.
No, actually, a friend of mine and I used to talk about this back when I was working for the religious station. Mm-hmm. And he said that our modern mythology was Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I began to even look at like the Next Generation
Good
series,
idea,
let
yeah.
alone the original series.
Yeah.
And thinking, my God, they deal with these kinds of questions and issues throughout these programs.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the greatest lesson they learned in making the movies, for example, rather than trying to resurrect a series, which they've done a couple, three times, the movies became long versions of episodes dealing with various issues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was a great thing.
And one of them was truth. I mean, they spend a lot of time dealing with truth. What is true? How do I know the truth? What is the truth?
Yeah.
They also spend a lot of time on what is good and what is evil.
Right. They spent a lot of time on reality. What is reality? Especially the one episode where somehow they managed to bring out of the holodeck Moriarty, Sherlock Holmes' arch enemy.
Yes.
And at the end of the episode, this was probably the most profound moment where they had encapsulated the digital knowledge or awareness of Moriarty in this box.
Yeah.
That wasn't more than a foot square, a cube. And Data is standing there holding it.
Uh-huh.
And he just kind of looks up and just says, computer, end program.
Right.
Not to the box, but to his reality, which meant that he even questioned whether or not he was living, even as an android, living in a holographic world that could just be turned off.
The beauty of the philosophical impulse is the questions that it asks rather than the answers that it offers.
I tend to agree with that, because it's like while you're asking the question, while you're musing and mulling over the question and trying to yourself before you go out and seek other input from outside yourself, there is sort of an energizing effect to the question.
Mm-hmm. It's focusing. It focuses you as a person. And this is what Cicero meant at the beginning of the show.
Interesting.
Now I think you're fleshing out exactly. You're having the same sentiments, I think, or similar sentiments that Cicero did. When we think philosophically, we are really preparing to die because we really are trying to perfect ourselves, not as moneymakers, not as professors, not as students, not as engineers and radio stations. No. Not as politicians, certainly not. Not as lawyers. No, 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 no. Not even as parents. We're perfecting ourselves as persons.
Mm.
Persons.
Interesting stuff.
Hmm?
Before we wrap up the program, and I think it was 2 years ago, a little over, no, it was 2010, so it's like 3 years ago you were on the program.
I think it was, yeah.
I wasn't asking these questions, but I am now.
Yeah.
And they are threefold.
Okay.
Who is Mark McIntyre?
I'll take him one at a time. Okay. Mark McIntyre is a person who is striving to be a person. Mm-hmm. He's a work in progress. Every day, Mark McIntyre asks himself four questions. What is real? What is true? What is good? And what is beautiful? Mark McIntyre marvels at the answers he gets at the end of the day, which is why Mark McIntyre sleeps very soundly. But Mark McIntyre is also someone who nurtures the life of ideas over the last 45 years, 43, I forget how many years it is, but that's what my greatest enjoyment of being on this planet has been and continues to be. I have a class tonight at 6 o'clock. Walking into a classroom and nurturing a life of ideas. Notice I didn't say giving people answers.
Mm-hmm.
I said nurturing a life of ideas.
Yeah.
That has been the greatest gift of being alive for Mark McIntyre.
On a side note, I have to say that the greatest aspect for me of teaching, and I haven't done a lot of it, but years ago I was teaching at one of the broadcast schools.
Mm-hmm.
I had to do it for an hour and 15 minutes. And I was so jazzed mm-hmm. about being able to impart
yeah.
what I had gathered
right.
over that short period of time
right.
to the people in the room who were sitting there trying to learn too.
Right. Right.
And one of the first things that I would tell them, and I would tell this to anybody, is if you don't want to be here, if this is not what you really want to do, then don't waste your time,
mm-hmm.
most importantly, your time.
Exactly.
Because I'm going to be here anyway.
No, you're going to be there anyway. Yeah.
Your parents' money,
yep.
okay,
yep.
on something that you really don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Go
mm-hmm.
find the passion of your life. I think that's so important.
Go find happiness.
Yes.
Neil Kreisel was on our show yesterday, the Minds That Matter show, and I was stuck in traffic, and I couldn't get to the studio. But Neil was reading a tremendously important article about, you know, these days the Obama administration measures the value of colleges by the monetary outcomes that are measured.
Oh yes, yes, yes.
And Neil was reading this article about that's the wrong way.
Yeah,
it should be about happiness.
Yeah,
you know, how many students are actually taking classes and enjoying it every single day? They can't wait to go to class. They can't wait to engage these ideas.
Yeah.
Very, very uncommon. Very, most students dread the idea of going to their classrooms. They dread the idea of getting a degree so they can get a job, so they can buy a house, so they can earn money to pay for their health care and die.
Well, that and their student loans.
Yeah. And I heard that from the Dalai Lama. The Dalai yeah, Lama, by yeah. the way, I actually had a conversation with the Dalai Lama, and he said that's the most tragic thing about modern humans.
Yeah.
He said they spend all this time pursuing the wrong things, thinking that they're going to make them happy.
Yeah.
And they spend the rest of their lives spending all the money that they accumulated, taking care of their health and going to psychiatrists and taking drugs and doing all this crazy stuff.
I feel a little bit like I'm out of the loop because I don't see a therapist.
No.
And yet there are many people that I have associated with.
Well, I'm Irish. We can't be psychoanalyzed.
Well,
did you know that?
No,
George Bernard Shaw proved that.
Yeah. I'll keep that in
with
mind.
With geometric logic.
Next question,
yeah.
number two.
Oh, yeah.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Ah, well, that follows on. Thank you very much for asking these questions. I have never been asked these questions. In all the interviews I've done over the years, no one has ever had the foresight and the courtesy, by the way, to ask these questions. All that I hope to do is to be a guide to those who come after me, to those I'm dealing with now, and hopefully people read my works, those who come after me and realize that it is not the answers that we find in life that is most probative, but it is the questions that we asked. Also, that it's not the things we say yes to in life that are so important, it's the things we say no to that are important. Mm-hmm. That's something that I have learned. And I offer that. It may not be true for you. You may not even agree with it. Another thing that I hope to instill is that it's not what we say or even how we say it. It's what we don't say and how we don't say it that is more often effective in inculcating a life of ideas. Asking questions should be our main process of becoming a better person. Because after all, I came into this life alone. I will be leaving alone unless anybody wants to join me. I can't think anybody does. But it's a very good question. And unfortunately, young people don't think about this, I think, enough because they think they're indestructible. But as we age, we really get a handle on the fact that in 500 years, it's not going to matter. It's not going to matter to anyone what I thought. At all. Mm-hmm. But it will only to matter to me now and to those that perhaps I can have a rippling effect in nurturing their life of ideas.
That kind of raises a sidebar question that I've been musing over, and I know I'm not the first because I don't believe in that concept of unique. I believe there's a biblical passage that there is nothing new under the sun or in the minds of man.
In Latin,
that last part is not part of the biblical passage.
In Latin, it's nihil noli sub soli. There's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah. And so the question has to do with why is it so important for the human race to continue on? And again, I'm not talking about, okay, today.
No, excellent question.
Today.
Yeah.
We have decided as a planet, as a people, no more people.
Right.
Okay. We're not going to bring any more people into the world.
Right. All right.
Whoever's pregnant, you give birth to them, and that's the end.
Right.
And then when those babies grow up and then they die, end of species.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it important for man to continue on into the future?
That's a very complex question. It's an extraordinarily profound question. And the only answer I can give you is that we have what I would like to call a consciousness imperative. I'll repeat that, a consciousness imperative. The evolution of human consciousness is what I'm talking about. There was a time in the development of human consciousness, and this is what people like Dawkins don't understand and don't get. There was a time when there was no such thing as human consciousness, even taking their own evolutionary point of view. How did it happen that non-material reality like thought and concepts evolved from purely material reality like atoms, molecules, dust, particles, gases, chemistry? How did that happen? There's not a biologist, including Dawkins, on the face of the planet that can give you an answer to that. No one. And if they say that they do, they're liars. Okay? So, but yet we have this evolutionary imperative. And I call it an imperative because consciousness, as Chardin pointed out, evolves. Chardin was a very profound paleontologist with a philosophical and religious and spiritual bent. And what he said was that there is a within of matter that is called consciousness. He believed that everything in the universe, even rocks and pieces of iron, had some level of consciousness in them, okay? And the reason why we think it's important to continue human beings, which is the substance of your question, is because we have a consciousness imperative. Genetically wired into the very stuff out of which we are made and out of which stars are made. Thank you, Carl Sagan.
And that imperative is that we
must continue.
Continue.
We must continue. Yes, we must continue.
Interesting.
Yeah. Even why do people get married and have babies? On a simple level, because they want to perpetuate themselves. Mommy and daddy don't like dying, and they want to have little Markies running around, because little Marky will grow up and he'll have babies and so forth and so on. It's self-perpetuation.
Yeah.
We're really upset about mortality. We think mortality is the cruelest joke that the universe has ever played on.
But the irony is that as much as we are upset about mortality, that, let's just, I'll take myself for example.
Sure.
All right, I'm upset about mortality.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
I want the species to continue. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't do me any good because I'm going to die.
Right.
I'm going to die, and just because the human race continues on, it doesn't change the fact that I'm not.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you're getting into the fact of being remember I said to you in 500 years think about famous people who are died recently, and now I can think of a very famous person that I knew for 27 years who's now dead. His name is Charlton Heston.
Right.
Okay. I was his friend for 27 years.
Right.
Okay. Who remembers him now? Maybe his family.
Yeah.
Maybe if you watch one of his films, you might remember him. But this is a man, while he was alive, he was known all over the planet.
Yeah.
Okay? What chance does Mark McIntyre, if I keel over driving home today,
yeah.
if I might be remembered for maybe 15 minutes, period.
Yeah.
End of story.
Right.
Right? And as the years advance, nothing.
Yeah.
Right? So this is why people have children, because, somebody will go to my grave and put flowers on. They'll say, oh, Mark was a great old guy. He was a good guy. You know, you should be more like Mark. This is why we do it. It's purely psychological.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Or psychiatric, depending upon your point of view.
Well, I will tell you that the genesis of the question comes from the birth of my great-grandniece.
Okay.
The great-grandniece. Okay. And
congratulations.
My concerns, I had nothing to do with it.
Well, you're reporting it. You're reporting
yes,
it.
I am. Okay. And the thought that came to me was, oh my gosh, I saw what my parents went through raising us.
Yeah.
And I've seen what my sisters and my brother have gone through raising their kids.
Sure.
Is she destined, and this is the way I phrased it, is she destined to the same fate as all of us, of being more than
you know
a consumer producer?
Now you've landed on something that it just grabs.
It breaks my heart
to
think.
It grabs the center of my being to think about. I call this the regardez. There's a point in every parent's life and the point in every child's life, if they're intelligent, when they look at the parent and they go, you did this to me? You propelled me into being?
Yeah.
What the hell were you thinking?
Yeah.
WTF, okay? WTF, Dad. That's why I like Breaking Bad so bad. The episodes of Breaking Bad. Because a young Walter looks at older Walter.
Yeah.
And by the way, you resemble Walter very much.
I know.
My goodness, almost frightening.
A little scary.
It's a little scary. Anyway.
But I have more gray than he does.
But you know what? If you are capable of asking yourself that question, Richard, then you have probably arrived at a very, very rarefied point of human consciousness, I would say. Because you realize that having babies is not a matter of a happenstance.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people, for instance, who do not have children for the very reason that it terrifies you to think that you would propel another person who would one day sit across from a table and have this type of a conversation.
Have you ever seen the movie Idiocracy?
No.
Well, the opening
15,
20 minutes takes place in present day.
Mm-hmm.
And it is showing the events unfolding, and I've shared this movie. I've encouraged people to watch this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny and scary at the same time. It
sure.
is not a horror film. Okay, it's a comedy.
Yeah,
but it's funny and scary at the same time. The basic premise is the military has this program there. They want to test out these life support systems to put people in suspended animation for, in this case, a period of 1 year.
Yeah.
And they get one of these guys. He's just an average Joe military guy. You know, he's sitting in a desk in a basement somewhere, manning a desk. That's the level of his education kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely enough, a prostitute. And they put one in one thing and one in the other.
No, who's the prostitute? The guy in the desk or the?
No, no. The guy is the guy in the desk is military.
Okay, and then there's another entity.
And then there's
called
another entity, prostitute. And so they put her in one and put him in the other.
Be a more interesting movie if he was the prostitute.
And it would be. And they close the doors. All right. And they say, okay, we'll see you in a year.
Yeah.
6 months down the road.
Yeah.
The program is unfunded. It's shut down, okay?
Oh,
and so these pods are just tossed on the pile on the garbage heap, right?
Uh-huh, right.
550 years goes by, and man has continued on. Well, in the scenes where they're preparing to go into the pods, they're cutting back and forth between this couple who is deciding to have children.
Ah.
Well, we're not going to have children just yet because whatever reason.
Yeah.
And actually, the first one is where she blames him because of his sperm count or whatever.
Right, 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 right.
and on and on. And then a couple of shots later, she's all by herself now. Mm-hmm. Well, at least I had the good fortune to freeze some of my eggs, but now is not the right time. I want to find the right donor. And eventually what ends up happening is she dies.
Mm-hmm.
And no eggs. Okay. Mm-hmm. Anyway, these two are now in 2555.
Yeah.
And they had what they referred to as the great garbage avalanche of 2555.
Okay.
And his pod comes sailing down the hill and into the front window of. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And so he wakes up,
yeah,
and this guy is watching TV.
Mm-hmm.
And the television program that he's watching is a program called Oh My Balls.
Oh My Balls.
And the entire show throughout,
ooh,
is this one guy,
mm-hmm,
constantly getting struck in the privates,
mm-hmm,
in various ways.
Okay.
The number one Oscar-winning movie that year,
mm-hmm,
was a movie called Ass. And for an hour and a half, you saw nothing
but ass.
But the behind of someone.
I see.
Uh-huh. It's just a still, basically.
Yeah.
And people would laugh.
Yeah.
That was the level of consciousness and mentality that had progressed in human.
To 2520.
2550.
Oh, 2550, yeah.
Anyway, I think still it's a great movie.
Yeah.
But not to belabor the point any further, certainly we want to sort of end on a more of a high note, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Is there a third question?
There is a third question.
Oh my
I haven't
God,
forgotten
I...
it. I wasn't stalling.
You're good. You're really good.
I wasn't stalling.
I almost forgot.
The third question,
yeah,
in light of what we've conversed about in the last almost hour and a half,
mm-hmm,
how powerful are we as human beings?
Well, we live in a vastly indifferent universe that is both beyond our even meager understanding and certainly even beyond our most modest control. I hope that answers your question.
Okay. How can people get a hold of you? This is separate from the three questions.
How can they can call the police.
Okay.
They can call the police.
That's one idea.
They can visit markmcintire.com, MarkMcintire. Mom's always said to spell it. And my email is mark@markmcintire.com. By the way, my teaching website is markmcintire.com. They can look at my – I have an open source – you can take my class without paying. The whole class is right there.
Right.
And there are 15 instructional videos, which are in my book. If you want to buy the book, you can buy the book there. So I have 15 instructional videos that are posted on YouTube. It's pretty easy to find Mark McIntyre. Yeah. And you can come here every Wednesday to AM 1290.
Mm-hmm.
Every Thursday. No, every Wednesday.
Wednesday. And
I missed one show and I missed the whole deal. And you come here and listen to Minds That Matter, which is sponsored by and presented by the Santa Barbara City College Foundation.
And you can also go to richarddugan.com. We are linked to your website as well.
And I'm linked to your website. So we have interlinking.
Interlinked. This conversation has just been fascinating and is not going to be the last.
I've enjoyed it. I think this has been fantastic. I want to thank you for drilling down into some very, very, very tough questions that forced me to call upon what little experience I have in thinking about those questions.
Well, I have to say that I think that more of us are, I think there are more of us who are starting to think about these questions. And as we do that, we are going to start to... Not necessarily, because as you say, it's the questions that are more important than the answers. It's the processes that we go through,
mm-hmm,
to try to deal with the challenges that we have placed ourselves in. And I put,
mm-hmm,
it that way,
mm-hmm,
not that we find ourselves in,
right,
but that we have placed ourselves in.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is the choices of yesterday,
mm-hmm,
that have put us in the place where we are today.
No,
it is the choices of today,
agreed,
that will put us into a new place, hopefully a better place, and,
mm-hmm,
a better world as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for the conversation.
Absolutely. I'm Richard Dugan. Mark McIntyre. MarkMcintyre.com is the website. I encourage you to check it out. You can't go wrong. Until next Saturday, I'm Richard Dugan. Love Talal.